Kristen says.
Only 45 minutes, but it seemed like 2 hours when you
This is Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services, Monday, April 6th. We have a public hearing on Senate Bill 5526, Oregon Health Authority. Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, today we'll hear a presentation on the last of the program units in OHA, health policy programs, and that will be followed by a summary of KPMs. And those are on OLIS as two separate documents.
Okay, thank you. Please begin.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Leslie Clement, and as Linda mentioned, I'm here this morning to talk about the health policy offices. This first slide, this presentation will describe the work of the policy offices that support OHA programs, and I'll review the key functions and outcomes produced by each office depicted on this slide. And all offices are collaborate to support the Oregon Health Authority's vision to perform functions that support a healthy Oregon with a focus on the mission to help Oregonians and communities achieve optimal physical, dental, mental, and social well-being. In the slides that follow, I'll describe how these offices are functionally designed with the purpose of providing enterprise-wide support to areas such as Medicaid, public health, and addictions and mental health. The health policy provides enterprise services helping to power the health system transformation to achieve the triple aim of better health, better care, and lower costs. Our specific goals include provide timely, reliable, accurate data, policy analysis, and evaluation of health system transformation to inform decision making. Secondly, to provide clinical oversight, evidence-based and best practice information, technical assistance to provide the right care at the right place, at the right time, with a focus on outcomes. To facilitate system technology partnerships to achieve effective and efficient care coordination. And to facilitate and convene experts and stakeholders in learning collaboratives to maximize the spread of best practices. Promoting and health equality to achieve cultural competency, develop and implement policies that reduce health disparities. So this slide shows a framework of how the health policies operate within the context of the Oregon Health Authority and identifies key forums and their work with stakeholders to accomplish the goal. So under the Office of the Chief Medical Officer, you'll see there the Health Evidence Review Commission that informs about coverage decisions. You'll see a Quality Improvement Council, which is an internal group that focuses on data and aligning strategies across Oregon Health Authority. And you'll note that this office then becomes the primary clinical liaison with the healthcare community. Our Office of Health Policy and Research plays the important role of staffing the Governor's Health Policy Board and its work groups and committees. This office often leads the key policy initiatives that result from this legislative body. The staff also support Medicaid's federally required Medicaid Advisory Committee, which with its focus on individuals who receive coverage from the Oregon Health Plan. Health Analytics has many data groups that they're responsible for, including the CCO Metrics and Scoring Committee, the newly formed Hospital Quality Performance Metrics. It also has responsibility for the all-payer, all-claims database. And you'll hear next from Lori Coyner, who's the director of this office, about our key performance measures. The Office of the Health Information Technology has its focus on health system delivery supports with key stakeholders, including CCOs, providers, the Oregon Health Leadership Council, and many other state agencies. And, of course, the Office of Equity and Inclusion has led the development of the traditional health workers and staffs the Council on Clinical or Healthcare Interpreters. Finally, the Transformation Center is a learning hub that convenes learning collaboratives supporting community advisory groups, councils, and the Council of Clinical Innovators. So that gives you a kind of a core of who they're all working with, and then, as you can see from the slide, the population served, and then the programs underneath. So historically, many of these policies office were spread throughout various programs. They were often siloed. There was redundant work going on in programs, and there was often a risk of not being coordinated. So we've gathered these together. They're centralized. With the ambitious health system transformation goals, OHA needed to ensure it was maximizing its resources and targeting the right skill sets to achieve the goals. Redirecting resources, OHA created the Office of the Medical Officer to manage medical directors in various programs throughout the agency to align policies, practices, and systems. The office also provided an opportunity to create a leadership role focusing on quality improvement, which is distinct from the usual quality assurance and compliance activities. Health analytics has become a fundamental driver of health system transformation with its role managing enterprise-wide data. I think you'll recall hearing from Judy Moore Peterson when she talked about the CCO metrics. Pam Martin with Addictions and Mental Health talked about their AMH dashboard. These are products that this office delivers to those programs. Establishing an office of HIT was also essential with its focus specifically on the health system delivery to provide effective and efficient care. And this is also consistent with how other states manage this particular scope of work. I want to turn now to provide a high-level description of each office, starting with the Office of Health Policy and Research. The staff here are really amazing with the quality of their work and their contributions to the health system transformation in Oregon. They not only tackle challenging policy topics such as the Medicaid eligibility churn and the workforce issues, but also produce necessary documents to demonstrate compliance with our federal waiver, and also to obtain policy approval for certain packages like the alternative benefits. The staff has also lead responsibility for coordinating analysis and working with national experts to evaluate whether these health system goals in Oregon are being achieved.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
I do not expect an answer to this now because I'm sure you don't have the data with you. I'm interested in the point you made about Medicaid churn. This was a big issue several years ago when we had a shorter Medicaid eligibility, but now we have guaranteed eligibility for a year, if I'm correct. About not anymore. That's changed. We did it for a while.
Yeah. So, co-chairs and Senator Steiner Hayward, there is a 12-month continuous eligibility for children. It's a federal law,
okay,
and it has to do with. It's often called that express lane eligibility,
right?
But for adults, CMS was informed by their attorneys that they actually would need to make an adjustment in the FMAP in order to do the same for adults. And when Oregon looked at that at the time, it was, that had a fiscal impact.
Sure.
And so we didn't pursue that adult 12-month continuous eligibility at the time, but that is on the radar for this office to do a deeper dive to go in and do the analysis to see what the cost-benefit analysis would be for proceeding ahead, so that's in the works.
Great, thank you so much.
Follow up?
Yes.
How do you do eligibility then for adults? Do you do it on a monthly basis, 6-month basis, annual basis? What are you actually doing?
Well, so, I'm not the eligibility expert, but for adults, if they have a change in income, any today, anytime throughout the year, it's their responsibility to notify us, and then we would have to assess their eligibility again. So that's what makes it not a 12-month eligibility. So if nobody contacts us, that means their income hasn't changed over time. But if they have a change in event, then they have to come back to us and notify, and we'll redo their eligibility.
Follow up.
Yes.
I'll let my good senator to my right go first.
Well, I'm guessing we're going to ask the same question.
Okay. I think so.
We deal with this in a bunch of programs, and I guess I'd like to know what a qualifying income change is. I mean, if somebody gets 10 hours of, or 15 or 20 hours of overtime in a month because somebody else is out sick and or on vacation, then does that kick them over, and then the next month they're off again? Is that one of the things that's causing churn?
Yes, that is true. In fact, if your income varies significantly from one month to the next, in our environment today, adults are required to report that change in income, whether it goes up or whether it goes down.
Good grief.
Yeah. So
follow
that's the challenge. That is the challenge ahead for us.
Follow up.
Yes. Your turn.
Considering the difficulty we have signing people up through the Oracle programs that we've set up, which are getting better, our march to Kentucky, this is incredibly important that we have an annual sign-up regardless of changes in income during that year. You can't function this way. Are you going to, if someone doesn't report to you and has a big medical bill, and then someone looks back and says, oh, you really weren't qualified that day, you're going to tell the CCO or the hospital or somebody else that that's not going to be paid for, you're in bankruptcy now? Mm-hmm. What are you guys thinking here? To be blunt, what are you thinking?
So, co-chairs and Senator Bates, it's a matter of complying with the federal laws to ensure that you're covering only eligible people. Our thinking is exactly as yours is this is, we do not want this type of churn. We want to pursue that continuous eligibility so that no one loses coverage and that it's sustained over time. In our first year, we had a lot of the ability to extend eligibility with approval from the federal government. But that's not the normal environment, and that's why it's important for us to pursue this officially in terms of continuous eligibility.
We'll take this question offline now.
Yeah, we'd like to follow up with you on that.
Sure, that's fine.
Thanks.
Okay. So I'm going to move to the Office of the Chief Medical Officer. As I mentioned previously, OHA repurposed existing staff and leadership to establish this office. The primary purpose is to provide clinical leadership that integrates services throughout OHA. Importantly, it provides Oregon's medical and health professionals with a single point of contact and accountability for clinical issues. Consistent with health reform, the office has been established to focus on outcomes and quality improvements. In addition to her oversight of Oregon Health Primary Care Program and Evidence Review Commission, Dr. Smith is OHA's project director for the State Innovation Model Grant and Activities. So with each of these offices, what I'd like to do is just briefly highlight some of the outcomes that are associated with their work.
And before you move on to that, I'd like to ask something that occurs to me after reading the previous slide. On 7, the chief medical officer, one of the areas that the CMO oversees is patient-centered primary care home program. One of my interest areas has been school-based health centers, and sometimes I feel like they're a bit of an orphan. They're something apart, but without it being able to address the health needs of students, CCOs would have a lot more to deal with if students aren't being treated for at least some basic things by the nurses. Nurse practitioners and other professionals that visit schools. So whether it's a school-based health center or school nursing, it seems that healthcare delivered at schools is part of our healthcare system. Mm-hmm. But how does that fit in with how we're overseeing a whole program and an entire system, as opposed to, well, we've got CCOs here, we've got hospitals there, and we've got private insurers and individual practice offices elsewhere. Where do school-based health centers or school nurses fit into this?
Okay. So what I'd like to do is get back to you with a fuller explanation of how that works within the Oregon Health Authority and what's done in public health and what's done in the medical assistance program, and then how that feeds into primary care services.
Okay. Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Yes, thanks.
So I was talking about the chief medical officer outcomes, and one of the, I think, very impressive things for Oregon was at a time when we realized such a tremendous increase in our enrollment in the Oregon Health Plan, and with the CCOs, we have now over 400,000 more individuals than we had at the end of or before open enrollment. Given that context, that we have more than 80% of our CCO members enrolled with a primary care home, speaks volumes to the great work that the CCOs have done in this area. When individuals are receiving care in primary care, we have tracked the data that shows that they're receiving more preventive services, and we also do member surveys which show that their satisfaction with care has increased.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
About receiving more preventative services real quickly. In the first year, we enrolled a tremendous number of people, obviously, and we did not see our expected increase in utilization. Mm. But we're starting to see, in some CCOs at least, a significant increase in utilization the first quarter of this year. Mm-hmm. Family care and some others have seen a big jump. That has a lot of implications for us. Are you seeing that across the, are you getting any numbers in yet the first quarter of this year compared to the first quarter of last year?
So we're doing a couple different things. So we're tracking our overall population, but then we're pulling out and we're tracking the ACA population separately. And what we saw was throughout 2014, a lower than expected utilization by those ACA members. I think it's still too early to tell what their utilization patterns will be after they've received coverage for a while, but Lori Koiner will be able to really respond to whatever details you need about what our experience has been to date, but we are tracking those separately.
Thank you.
Yep. Let's see what else I want. I guess one of the things that I think is just important to highlight, and I think you've all been informed of this and met our new dental director, but it is indicative of the focus that we're trying to make in terms of integrating the importance of oral health into our programs. And so that's a relatively new administrative position for us, but we're looking forward to that individual helping to coordinate and align across the program. Our new quality improvement director, we're also looking forward to that opportunity to align efforts. So, and most importantly, I think, and if I didn't mention this, I'm sure we'd hear from Dr. Smith afterwards, that really an important function out of her office, especially as the director of the SIM grant, is to ensure that we're looking forward, that we're moving these coordinated care elements into PEB, into OEB, and working with private health plans to get those plans on board with incorporating the elements of the care coordination model into their procurement efforts so that all Oregonians can experience the same kind of benefits that CCO members have. So this slide, I think it's going to be used a number of times in a number of places, but I think it says it all. And it's really what gets measured gets managed. And you'll see here, too, there is a link to this for those of you who want to do a deeper dive on the 2014 mid-year health system transformation report. That report will be finalized at the end of June, so we'll have a full year of data that shows how CCOs perform with respect to these quality metrics in the second year of their existence. The Office of Health Analytics has really been essential for supporting Oregon's health transformation efforts. It really is policy in action. It's been redirecting staff resources with the necessary skill sets so that they can provide agency-wide support and information about service utilization, financial, and quality data that will drive performance. Health Analytics also manages and produces and oversees the development of a number of reports that include but are not limited to the member surveys, health coverage analysis. I think some of you have seen the county uninsured rate. That report was produced out of this office. This office is the point of accountability for data coordination and integration across OHA. Some of the outcomes, and again, this should look familiar to you, but this reflects the work that Health Analytics does to support the medical assistance program and paying for performance on 33 measures. They've established the protocols and the procedures to ensure that the data integrity exists. And they establish the procedures and work with our finance officers to make sure that CCO performance payments are processed in a timely way. We are paying for quality for the first time with our hospital quality metrics, and this is the office that does that work. And then there are other tools that this office is using to develop dashboards so that programs like addictions and mental health can monitor service utilization. This slide reflects a number of the office's results over the past year. They staff the Sustainable Healthcare Expenditure Work Group, which is a group that reports to the Oregon Health Policy Board. And that is developing methodology on total statewide healthcare spending that crosses Medicaid, commercial health plans, Medicare, to see how we're trending and how we compare against those different type of coverage plans. This office also has managed the APAC database and produced a dashboard which reflects the utilization and coverage of all those plans. And under Director Saxon's leadership, we'll continue to focus on transparent performance data, which includes evaluating race and ethnicity disparities to inform effective strategies for improvement. I'm going to move now to the Office of Health Information Technology. Susan Otter has done an impressive job leading her team and modeling collaborative communications with her customers. These office goals include leading efforts to provide access to timely patient information in order to support coordinated integrated care, to facilitate statewide efforts to collect and use clinical data for quality improvement efforts, to support efforts for patient engagement through access to their own clinical data. And there are a few quotes here from our CCO leadership, specifically from the CEO of Trillium, of Western Oregon Health Advanced Health, and Cascade Health Alliance, and now the Willamette Valley Community Health CEO, that really express the importance of the work that the Office of Health Information Technology performs here.
I'm going to interrupt again with a question that I wouldn't necessarily expect you to have the answer for today, okay. But I really would like to hear something about it. I have seen more than one bill coming through the legislature this session related to the health information technology initiatives, and I am a little surprised to see some language buried deep in some of those bills where OHIP would be, it appears to be being carved out of state rules for accountability or oversight or connecting with other offices. It appears to be viewing itself as rather autonomous rather than part of state agencies, using the state CIO, the Chief Information Office, for advice or oversight. And I'm wondering if you could tell me what that's about and what the rationale is, why the health authority should be set apart from all other state agencies in that regard.
Okay. Representative Nathanson, members of the committee, I'll do a partial answer, but I expect that we can do a more comprehensive follow-up if that would be helpful.
Sure.
A couple things. I don't think there is an intent to carve out OHIP from our agency or disconnect them from the Office of Information Technology or the state CIO. We all have to follow those same processes and procedures. There are some unique situations that occur where, and I'll give you an example that actually shows up in a couple slides that follow, but the Emergency Department Health Information Exchange is an effort that was really put together across multiple health plans, all the hospitals in the state of Oregon, and so we've got health systems, health plans. We also have a state role in that as a Medicaid agency. And that was really set up as a single solution for the state of Oregon to make easy connections, to exchange those notifications in a streamlined fashion. The state is a key partner in that. And in that particular case, to subject the state to undergo a distinct and separate procurement process wouldn't align with the consistent statewide tool that the health systems and health plans have elected. So it's balancing out a little bit what is a requirement that provides value and protections versus something that takes you through administrative requirements and actually creates a delay or a disconnect from the rest of the system. And I hope this is an okay way to describe it, but it's thinking it about it in terms of a private public utility model. And if you've got one entity in that model that has to go through different steps, you're going to provide a disconnect, especially with Oregon Health Plan, which now has over a million enrollees. So it dramatically impacts how we work as a system and systematically across. So we don't want to say, well, we don't have to bother with any of those rules. We want to be consistent. We want to have the integrity that gives us the assurance that we are appropriately using money correctly. On the other hand, we don't want to bifurcate the system. Mm-hmm. So I can provide more information later. Certainly would want to rely on my experts to do it, but I think the EDI tool is a good example of where that becomes a very big challenge, not being able to partner in that.
I see. Thank you. Senator.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. You know, I just glanced ahead to make sure that I wasn't going to ask something you're about to address, and it looks like I'm not.
Okay.
Do you all do any coordination with your counterparts in DHS and DHCS? And the reason they ask, you're nodding, which is good, because a lot of the people who are served by OHP programs are also receive services from some of these other agencies, and really when we provide coordinated services, I think we get a lot more bang for our buck. So could you talk about that really briefly, or would you prefer to do that at another time?
No, Co-chairs, Senator Steiner Hayward, I'd be glad to briefly address it. I think in this office in particular, I think there are many examples in OHA where we are together in joint governance area. So we have a joint policy governance body that has DHS leaders and OHA leaders at the same table. We have a joint policy committee that has OHA and DHS leaders at the table. With respect to the Office of Health Information Technology, Susan often confers with and seeks out input and advice and offers actually opportunities to use certain tools that are provided out of her office, and CareAccord is a great example of that. It's a direct, secure messaging. It's the state's health information exchange. It's a no-cost tool that's available. And for DHS programs in particular that haven't benefited from things like the Medicaid incentive program because they're not eligible, they're not eligible according to federal rules, they can use these tools to help better plug into that system where they can communicate with medical practices and across behavioral health practices. So in that way, there's that example in the Office of Health Information Technology. Is that?
It's a starting point. I think I'd like to take this conversation offline and have a more detailed conversation with you and maybe your counterparts in those other agencies.
Okay.
Senator, thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair. This probably is more of a question for Susan Otter. I did some checking last week as much as I could, and I talked to a lot of different groups. By the way, Mrs. Otter got some pretty high marks from people around the state for what you're doing. But there's also some concerns. Basically, what we have in this state is multiple different providers and different types of groups, hospital settings, non-hospital settings, private practices, large private practices, small practices. And we've got upwards of 20 different electronic medical records out there, maybe more than 20. Okay? The real question for the patient is that the right information gets to a particular provider at the time they need it to safeguard that patient and get that patient the best possible care. Now, that's the real problem. All the things you've talked about are interesting, but it's pretty high level. Mm-hmm. But the real problem is we got information flowing all over the place, and we don't have what we need when that patient is seen at an ER, hospital setting, or whatnot. As an example, I saw a patient last summer who had had 12 CT scans in the previous 6 weeks by going to different... She, I mean, I was scared to stand too close to her, okay? I mean, she's not very sophisticated about her health care, but hitting ERs and doing things, getting the same thing over and over again. So I want to ask a couple of questions about some systems. Okay. I know the Jefferson Information System is actually bringing together the information you really need, and they believe, and I won't use the guy's name, but he's the chair of their group. He believes the biggest problem is not a technical one, that we have off-the-shelf programs that can bring these portals together. The problem is a political one of getting people in different systems to actually open up and allow the information to flow. And I want an answer from you on that, if you can give it to us. What's holding us back? The second thing was there's nothing that we can see going on statewide that's even close to what Jefferson Exchange is doing, as they've actually broken some of those political barriers down, the information starting to flow. Second thing is I want to know more about the EDI program, and I want to know more about CareAccord. When you say that in the EDI program you get notifications, what notifications are you getting? What actual information is flowing back and forth? Do you know the answer to that?
Yes.
Thank you. I'd like to hear that answer.
Okay. So it's actually it's a phased approach, right? So the first beneficiaries of the EDI system are really the hospitals themselves and the ED areas specifically. In addition to emergency room utilization, so that flag that says that this individual has also just been over in our emergency room, you get access to their treatment plan and you get information about the utilization of that person's ED use. added to that is the any inpatient admissions and then discharges from the hospitals. That's all kind of a phase one and phase two.
Follow up.
Yes.
When the ER doctor sees a patient, do they see the medical record on that patient from outpatient services, all the services the patient has received, not just that they've been to an ER somewhere across the state the other day, do they get the information about the patient, what they were there for, what medications they were given, what the outcome was, where they were sent to afterwards? Mm-hmm. Not just notification, but the actual records. Do they receive that?
Yeah, let me get Susan up here so she can give you a more comprehensive answer. So.
Senator Bates, members of the committee, my name is Susan Otter. I'm the Director of Health Information Technology for the Oregon Health Authority. I'm thrilled that you're asking about Eddie today. It's one of our big successes of the last year. So the Emergency Department Information Exchange does not include all outpatient information. It includes the what's called the admit, discharge, and transfer information from the hospital. These are standardized feeds that come out of a hospital's electronic health record, and that includes high-level information from the hospital visits, when they're admitted, discharged, or transferred into the ED or out of the ED, into inpatient or discharged home. So it has information like demographics, it has the diagnosis, and those types of things.
Follow up.
Yes.
Does it have the discharge summary?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that you were asking that. So, Senator Bates, no, the discharge summary itself has not been added. That has been identified as a key thing that would be helpful for, particularly for primary care, to be added to the system down the road. So it's on the roadmap of the Emergency Department Information Exchange, but it's not currently in. Part of the reason for that is the discharge summary is not part of those basic feeds that are produced electronically from the hospital electronic health records. It's something that would have to be programmed. It's still in the electronic health record. It's just an additional body of work that would need to be added to make those available. I'd like to add one quick thing. Which is that the Emergency Department Information Exchange also allows for care guidelines to be added by the hospital staff or by the primary care or health plan staff that are accessing this service through a separate program called PreManage. Those care guidelines and other attachments like pain contracts, care plans can be uploaded into the system and made available. So the automatic feeds that come in are those hospital-based feeds, but other information can be added in. The care guidelines are really important. They're the Cliff Notes version of what's happening for that patient, so that the emergency room physician or staff can see right away if somebody has primary care provider or case manager they need to be in contact, can identify that there is a pain contract on record and various things.
Just a quick comment. I thought in our area that we were probably sort of lagging behind the state. We're kind of a rural area down in southern Oregon. In fact, I guess we're leading the state. I get that right now.
Yeah, that's
okay,
right.
And the rest of the state doesn't. I would like to have an offline comp. I mean, I think maybe we've got the Jefferson Exchange. It needs to be spread across the state. We can have that conversation. We're already doing it. We must be ahead of the rest of the state.
Senator Bates, Jefferson AJE is a model that is at the top of our communities in Oregon. And they've recently spread to the Columbia Gorge area as well, which we're very excited about.
And they're getting ready to go into Bend, and maybe we should have a conversation about what we do with the rest of the state. If they've got something, it really works. And they believe that the technology is there. It's going to be flipped. The problem is more of a political problem among systems. People don't want to open their system up and share information on patients, and we'll have a conversation about that. Can I jump to another question? I don't want to tie up people too long.
Sure. We have 45 minutes.
How many more slides do we have?
And we also have performance measures to do today.
We'll take us offline.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You know, Madam Chair,
Senator Winters,
I think it's important because not all of us have have the knowledge that you have. And we're talking about an extremely important subject. Then I sat here and I was very surprised in my limited knowledge about medical records and what was contained. And I was kind of taken aback when I found that the discharge summaries was not yet, and I've been a long time since I was up on the Hill. But
it hasn't changed much.
I'm trying to think of what's important if I'm sitting in the doctor's office and what I review. Is there, and you said there's still work and it is coming, but I would think you'd want to speed that up. Because the doc or the in the clinic is not having to second guess what they think is occurring. Am I not correct?
Or just not know. Just not know what the hell happened in the ER last night, and you got the patient in front of you, and you have no clue what happened. And the patient can't tell you.
Yeah, there's a bunch more stuff, but I'd like to be part of this conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Thank you.
And that's not a criticism. I got really good notes on. I mean, people say you're doing a great job.
Yeah.
So don't you? We're not criticizing here.
Great.
Okay. You need to move forward, that's all.
Thank you. I'm thrilled that you're interested in this area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I live it every day. Yeah. I'm kidding.
I'll continue. I'll pick up the pace just a bit because I think we have covered some of these areas with Susan just now. I guess I do want to point out, and Senator Bates, I really appreciate the recognition of Susan Otter's leadership here. I think she's just a model for how to work with the healthcare delivery system leaders. This slide is about the functions that the office provides in the state, the different roles of supporting and standardizing, aligning, and providing tools. But I also, in the very little print, you can see that she's working with some major leaders of our healthcare system and is a partner in that that effort. We have the Oregon Health Leadership Council with 35 senior leader level executives representing the host of health care system. We have the Oregon Health Information Technology Oversight Committee, which is a statewide advisory committee that was appointed by the governor. That office in itself is in a piece of legislation that will move under the Oregon Health Policy Board. And then a really great collaborative relationship with the CCO Health Information Technology Advisory Group. So hand in hand, working through these implementation strategies and really maximizing the use of our Medicaid resources when we can help bring people onto these systems sooner. So we covered a lot of these things. This is the highlights of what OHID has provided in the last year and their participation in the EDI system. Medicaid health electronic health records are another really important piece, and frankly, that's probably what started this office, because like other states across the country, when the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act was passed, it was really about having federal resources to help provide incentive payments for hospitals and eligible healthcare providers to actually acquire electronic health records. They didn't have them, or they needed to take them further in their development. And you can see the amount of funds here that were managed by this office and delivered to providers throughout the state. Care Accord, we touched on briefly, is a really exciting opportunity to bring others into this area of exchange of information who actually, frankly, have been left out and haven't had affordable ways to participate in it. So you know how important it is for our behavioral health providers to link into the system. So I think I'll leave it there, and then we can move on, and I'll cover a couple more of the offices briefly so we can respect your time. The Office of Equity and Inclusion is a really key office that OHA looks to promote the best practices of diversity development for both our internal agency and external customers. Their work helps inform recruitment, hiring, retention, and contracting processes that achieve greater diversity and cultural competency. The OEI staff support agency-wide services and programs. They collaborate hand in glove with DHS, and they lead promotional activities as well as policies to promote health equity. Some of the results from their efforts include establishing 5 healthcare interpreter certification tests to better serve individuals who speak Russian, Vietnamese, Mandarin, Korean, and Cantonese. I think you'll have heard from individuals who try to enroll populations who speak different languages how incredibly difficult that is if you don't have these kinds of efforts underway. The office was also responsible for creating the traditional health worker commission. They have developed information and resources to better serve migrant farm workers. They're collaborating on diversity recruitment, and they played a key role in supporting behavioral health integration and access to services for African and African Americans.
Senator Bates.
No, Senator Winters. You mentioned the 5 health care interpreters. Can I assume that the Hispanic interpreters are in another category, since they're the largest emerging population in the state?
Yes, these were kind of the next wave of certification tests that had not been addressed. I'm going to move to talking about the Transformation Center. So the Transformation Center was implemented in 2013 as a hub for health system innovation and learning for Oregon's health system in support of the Triple Aim. The primary goals of the Transformation Center are to champion and promote health system transformation in partnership with CCOs, providers, payers, and communities, and to build effective continuous learning networks for CCOs and their providers, and foster, most importantly, foster the spread of transformation beyond Medicaid. And leadership from the top of organizations drives transformation. So the center activities that foster leadership include the statewide CCO Learning Collaborative, and there's a monthly learning collaborative specifically for CCO medical directors, dental directors, behavioral health directors, and quality improvement coordinators who get together routinely to facilitate that peer-to-peer learning and help advance innovative strategies. The Council of Clinical Innovators Fellows Program is a statewide multidisciplinary cadre of emerging leaders who actively work to implement local healthcare system projects in their communities. And then the transformation staff use outside consultants and experts to provide technical assistance, but they also manage those transformation fund grants that help foster innovation at the local level. And this slide just gives you a little bit of a sense of the volume of learning collaboratives that have been convened since 2013. But it's not just about convening people and having them talk. It's also about encouraging them to take what's learned from these meetings and implement them in their communities and in their local environments. And so this chart really shows 3 of our important learning collaboratives where we receive feedback that you can see that very high percentages found these learning collaboratives to be valuable or very valuable, and the percentage who plan to take action as a result of participating in the collaborative was also very impressive. And those areas focus on a really important area, which are the performance incentives. So we want to learn. We want to help folks learn how to implement quality changes so that they can start providing better outcomes. We want those community advisory councils that are made up primarily of members and local communities to really play a key part in the governance of CCOs. And then we also had a very successful learning collaborative on complex care. Some of you were able to attend this past year's annual CCO or CCM summit. I need to be careful with that because it really is a coordinated care model summit, which is about the best practices. We had over 1,200 participants in that summit, and 88% of those individuals indicated that they would be taking back things that they learned from the summit to implement in their local communities.
Madam Chair, really yes. Quick question. This stuff is really exciting to me because I've had a long-term concern about how do you disseminate best practices and new evidence into practices across the state in a diverse environment. And I'm interested to know whether the health authority has already been thinking now about how to sustain these as we move out of our waiver over the next few years, because obviously these cost money to run. Mm-hmm. I think they're an extraordinarily good investment, and I think that's being demonstrated by what you're telling us today. Mm-hmm. But I'd love to know a little bit about how we're thinking about sustaining and growing these in the long term.
Okay. Co-Chair Senator Steiner Hayward, excellent question, and reflects conversations that we've been having in the recent weeks about 2017 is going to be here sooner than we think, and that it's not too early to start having discussions about how we move forward with our sustainability plans for these key activities. We do know that at least right now our federal government is really pleased with the CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, are really pleased and excited about the work of the Transformation Center. We know that another state in the country has actually been able to get CMS to agree to incorporate some of these activities in their waiver. So right now, these are primarily funded through the SIM grant. Our hope is that we can move key functions under the waiver in the future.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Just to follow up and look into the future, but just in case that doesn't transfer, do you have a plan B on the shelf or preparing for plan B on the shelf?
Well, co-chairs and Senator Winters, it's a great question. We are beginning those planning discussions right now. And you know, I think we can look to some of our successes in the past, and I'll mention it later in the presentation. We're pretty aggressive in seeking out grant opportunities, so that certainly will be one area that we look to. But we're going to have to really target what we believe is the most effective, what has been the most effective activities and resources that we have today, and pursue those. So plan B isn't mapped out. Plan A is just being worked through. Okay. So these are, I'll take just a couple minutes to review these, the budget donuts of our office. The health offices of the health policy budget are really less than 1% of the overall OHA budget. They do total $138.6 million, as you see, with 83% of its funding from federal funds. Historically, as I mentioned, our offices have aggressively sought out grant opportunities, which really have been critical to funding new and innovative programs and services. Our total position count of these offices is 162 positions with 135.8 FTE. That really reflects that we've got those funds available through grants and other sources. Those are limited duration positions. On this next budget slide, this really shows the distribution of those dollars across the policy offices. And more than half of the health policy budget benefits healthcare providers and programs with what I mentioned earlier, the Medicaid incentive payments for electronic health records, using federal matching dollars to facilitate greater participation in system tools like EDI, telehealth projects, and other system delivery tools to improve care coordination. And many funds are used to acquire external state and national experts in areas such as evaluation, data analysis, alternative payments, and clinical systems. Our major budget drivers are really about the task of building and modifying infrastructure to support the implementation of healthcare transformation beyond this startup phase of CCOs. The health policy offices are currently working with OEB to incorporate key transformation elements into their procurement efforts. So those primary care offices, the policy offices are all contributing to that effort. And beyond OEB, resources are continuing to be devoted to encouraging the spread of these elements into private and commercial and Medicare health plans, where population health may be different, but the delivery system is the same. And so for those physicians and medical practices working in this area, they really prefer that most of our systems are aligned so they don't have to deal with different requirements from different payers. So as we move from counting widgets to measuring and managing quality performance, our offices need to develop the appropriate tools to sustain the transformation efforts as well as provide really practical tools and information. So each of our offices is tasked with a different enterprise scope, ranging from management of emerging state and federal policy to facilitating and producing products that support paying for outcomes and performance. So I'm going to talk about a couple of the governor's investment areas. And this first area is kind of what we just talked about, so I won't go in too much detail, but it's really about how to take the critical work that is currently resourced by the SIM grant that's ending October 2016. The last of those funds runs out at the end of September. We're focusing on target areas within a 9-month time frame, and these funds would support the continuation of resources to sustain our efforts throughout the state and local communities. While the SIM grant currently funds 44 positions, the investment proposal seeks to continue less than half of these positions. The areas of support include the Transformation Center activities that focus on behavioral health and oral health services integration, clinical innovation, and coordination with other health-related services in early learning, public health, and social services. Health analytics to continue a contract for managing and maintaining data from its all-payer, all-claims database for the production of metrics used to evaluate CCO performance, and the Office of CMO to produce usable system provider tools. So sustaining this work under the CCOs and public and private purchasers and other key stakeholders to achieve the triple aim for improving healthcare. The next governor's investment has to do with the REAL Plus D. This you'll be hearing from Leanne Johnson and her DHS counterpart. It's a requirement to standardize and align practices across the two agencies for the collection of race, ethnicity, and preferred spoken, sign language, preferred written, language and disability status. The expected outcome is to provide accurate data to identify health and human service disparities and to support effective response to address those disparities and enable evaluation of improvement. As Director Saxton stated, our goal is to eliminate health disparities and attain the highest level of health for all people in Oregon. And in order to do that, we need this data to know who those populations are. I won't spend too much time on this. I think you probably have already been deep in the conversations about these different proposals. These are the legislative packages coming out of the Health Policy Office's. House Bill 2419 is primarily a housekeeping bill. It cleans up language to reflect more of the current OHA structure. Senate Bill 2013 expands the workforce database to include several critical healthcare professionals. And Senate Bill 231, your favorite, is about the multi-payer collaborative, and it's really about trying to get everyone across the state, all plans, to engage in real meaningful construction of payment models that will support and sustain primary care. So in conclusion, the offices of the health policy support services and programs within the Oregon Health Authority and external partners to achieve the triple aim. Our recent focus has been to support efforts that reduce per capita costs with policies that emphasize early intervention, prevention, and the right care at the right time, to support health care coverage, tracking enrollment data, and coverage rates by county, reporting on the success of Oregon's 95% insurance rate, and managing and coordinating efforts to improve specific health outcomes, expanding beyond health, physical health to behavioral health and population health. That concludes my presentation, and I'll be glad to answer any more questions, or we can get Laurie right up here to talk about KPMs.
I think we're ready to talk about key performance measures. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have to get a lot of people together to go okay.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Lori Coyner. I'm director of health analytics and going to present on the key performance measures for the Oregon Health Authority this morning. The key performance measures are framed around the triple aim of better care, better health, and lower cost, and that's also the underpinnings of our health system transformation. To that end, the metrics are aligned with health system transformation efforts that are outlined in our Medicaid waiver, as well as some population health measures that line up with work that's being done in public health. In my presentation today, I have all of the measures and results for each, and if time runs out, we'll make this slide deck available and you can see them all. They're categorized into three groups. So the first set that I'm going to go through align with our CCO performance measures. The second set aligns with other metrics that we report to CMS as part, or the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services as part of our waiver requirements. And the third set are population health. So feel free to have me move ahead if you have interest in the other areas. You saw this graphic from Leslie. I think the point is here, from my perspective, is that metrics promote change. We've seen the most change in the incentive measures. So those are the measures that there are dollars tied to for improvement. And I'm going to go through a number of the these metrics that are part of the 17 performance metrics that the CCOs are paid for. One of them is new starting 2015. So the measures are assessments for children in DHS custody. These are children that enter the foster care system, and the measurement is that they have a physical and mental health assessment within the first 60 days that they are under foster care. In 2015, because we've rolled in dental, now they need to have, the measure has been expanded, and the requirement is that children have a physical health assessment, a mental health assessment, and a dental assessment within the first 60 days. The second measure is effective contraceptive use. This had been what we called a core performance measure as part of our waiver, but now the Metrics and Scoring Committee established it as an incentive measure starting in 2015. Follow-up after hospitalization for mental illness has been an incentive measure throughout. Follow-up care for children prescribed ADHD medications has been an incentive measure, and it was retired, and I'll show you results why.
Yes,
really quickly.
I'm sure we've talked about this 1,000 times, but 60 days for assessments for children in DHS custody? I mean, Representative Stark can probably speak about this with even more clarity than I, but 60 days in the life of a foster parent is a really long time. Especially if a child has unidentified mental health needs that would benefit from interventions to support that child, especially during the time of the trauma of being separated from parents. Okay, that's 60%, that's just with the 60-day benchmark, right?
Co-chairs and Senator Steiner Hayward, the reason that 60 days was selected is there's a federal requirement that children have to have an assessment, a physical health assessment and a mental health assessment within 60 days. I believe one of those assessments is 30, and I will have to get back to you whether it's the physical or mental because I can't remember. Because the performance statewide in 2011, before we implemented this, was only half of kids entering foster care were receiving those assessments, and the benchmark, you'll see Metrics and Scoring Committee established a high benchmark of 90% with the reason that you're just describing, that it's very important. We've seen some steady improvement, but it's still a stretch. And then now we've added the dental health dental assessment as well.
Thank you, Chair. In our experience, at least, and my understanding was the medical was within 30 days, mm-hmm. and typically the physicians have been very accommodating for that. We've been able to get children in very quickly with that. Mental, I thought, was 60 days, mm-hmm. and sometimes there's a little bit of a wait. The dental is actually where it's a little trickier because there are a limited number of providers that you can take them to, and so we in the past have bumped up against that deadline trying to get them in. But as far as medical in 30 days and getting them quickly, I mean, we usually have an appointment within a couple days. So,
thank you very much. And my apologies, I've got a separate meeting. I've got a bookie, too.
I'd like to ask you to explain a bit more about why access to dental care is more limited than access to other care. You can either do it now or do it later. And I also want to ask, the improvement from 2013 to 2014 is a little bit, but is that enough to be statistically significant, or might it just be the nature of the population that particular year?
Representative Nathanson, I'll take a stab at both. First off, the dental assessments have not we have not measured those yet because it's for 2015 and we're still relatively at the beginning of the year, and we have to wait for claims to come in, so I can't speak to the how well the performance is for the dental yet at this point, but I can provide preliminary data for you if you'd like, and or we can talk about that offline. The second answer to your question, and I do want to point this out for all of our metrics, you'll that I'm well, many of the metrics that I'm reporting today, is we have the 2013, this light blue bar that's up there is calendar year 2013, and the other, the dark blue bar is a six-month roll forward, so it's July 2013 through June of 2014. So we don't yet have, we are calculating the final 2014 calendar year right now. It requires 3 months of what we call claims run out, so we need to wait for all the bills to come in. We just pulled the data on April 1st to look at the calendar year 2014, and so we may see a bigger jump. I don't know whether it's statistically significant, but we certainly can calculate that for you.
Thank you.
Chair, would you like me to comment? Thank you, Chair. I have not seen the numbers, so I can't verify that this is accurate, but talking to a number of dentists in my community and asking them why it's so hard and why so many of them do not accept the Oregon Health Plan is straight up with the reimbursement rates. They say that the rates for, especially if someone is new going into practice, it's very difficult for them to actually keep their business afloat, and so it's usually a larger group that comes together that's able to pull that off. And in my community, I'm only aware of one actual group that has that, and so therefore they get booked out pretty far.
Mm-hmm. So, would you like me to move on? I'm not going to walk through the rest of these so that we have time to look at the data, if that's okay with the committee. Oops. So here we just looked at the health assessments for children in foster care. It's been improving, though, as noted earlier, we're still far from where we want to be as a state. We have looked at the information by race and ethnicity, and American Indian and Alaskan Native children in foster care were more likely to receive health assessments. We do see improvements. The way you read this graph is the gray dots are blue, I mean, are the 2011 data that was presented on the prior page. The light blue dot is the 2013 experience, and the dark blue dot is 2014. You don't see many of the light blue dots because they're covered by the dark blue, so that if you don't see it, it's covered. So you can look at the change in the assessment rates by each race ethnicity category in this graphic.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Bates.
So in getting this measurement, is this just for a physical examination once a year, or is this any contact they have with a physician? In other words, or a healthcare provider, they go in for a sore throat or something, gets seen. Do you count that as an assessment, which I hope you would, but what are you counting here? Is it, it's an annual, somewhere along the line, once a year they get a contact?
Senator Bates and the rest of the committee, this is a breakout by race and ethnicity of the assessment for children in foster care. And so this measures the proportion of time that children receive both a mental health visit and a physical health visit within 60 days of being in custody.
Okay, so when a health assessment occurs within 60 days, that's all this is, the first 60 days,
yes.
That's all.
Here's some preliminary data on effective use of contraceptive methods. You'll see that women on Medicaid are slightly higher than the general population of Oregon. However, this measure comes from the Behavioral Risk Factor Survey, and starting in 2015, when we measure this for the coordinated care organizations as an incentive measure, we will be using claims data for that measure, and so the proportions may look slightly different. And this is a new incentive measure beginning in 2015.
Madam Chair, can we have us a little more detail about what these things mean? What's an effective use of contraceptive methods?
So,
you just tell us that quickly as you do these
things.
Sure. Help.
The effective contraceptive measures are those contraceptive that are long-acting and have a high success rate. So they would be an IUD, the oral contraceptives, and so not over-the-counter, no condoms or I think no foam. So it's And I'd have to get back to you about what the level of effectiveness is the line, but it's typically those contraceptive methods that have over 90% effectiveness.
Okay, fine. It's because you prescribe it doesn't mean it happens. Okay. Keep going. I'm sorry.
This metric shows the proportion of Medicaid members who have a hospitalization for mental illness and have a follow-up within 7 days. It's been improving slowly across time, but we are approaching the national 90 percentile benchmark.
So the 90th percentile is only 68.8?
Yes.
This is truly terrible. Mm-hmm. Not your fault. You're giving us the information. Thank you. We're not going to kill the messenger here. Okay. This is terrible. Mm-hmm. I mean, it should be follow-up immediately. I mean, if you went to one-day follow-up, I hate to see what these numbers look like. Probably zero. You're sending people off from an acute mental illness with probably 5 days of medication and putting them off the street. That's what we're really doing here. You're just giving a dab. I appreciate that.
Well, it's sad that the goal is so low, too.
Huh?
It's sad that the goal is so low.
It should be 100% in 24 hours.
Senator Bates, this has been recognized and one of the hospital performance metrics that aligns with the coordinated care organization metrics is this for that reason.
Thank you. Just pointing it out for the committee, because we have some stuff we're going to have to work on in this committee on this.
Here is the follow-up after hospitalization for mental illness by race and ethnicity. There are some decreases across time among African Americans and Asian Americans, and most of the increase has occurred among Hispanics and white groups.
I'd like to add something to the concern about follow-up care for mental illness. As we hope to be able to help people in settings that aren't a hospital, if there's some other facility that's been developed, the non-hospital ED, if you will, it's just in another facility, will we not be collecting statistics on those because this is defined as after hospitalization?
So for this particular measure, it does only count and look at visits where there was an inpatient hospitalization. However, we do Office of Health Analytics is coordinating with the Office of Health Information Technology, and we are receiving some pilot data from the EDI information on emergency department use, and to look at psychiatric holds within the emergency department. We are working right now with a test data set to see whether we can draw that information and learn more about those members that enter the emergency department and are held on a psych hold and because there may not be no inpatient beds. So we are analyzing that data currently.
Well, I'm glad. That's interesting. I would also be interested, though, to see outcomes for people who haven't been taken to a hospital, whether they stayed or didn't stay. We're hoping that there may be other facilities that are available for people to go to for mental health emergencies. We've heard about at least one already, and there may be others that develop. And as we try to encourage this type of treatment or intervention for mental health emergencies, we could end up losing our tracking for something that we're actually interested in promoting. Did that make sense?
Yes, Representative Nathanson, I will coordinate with Pam Martin, and we do also collect and report data for the Department of Justice, and which looks at residential facility use and some of that sort of thing. And we may be collecting it in the AMH dashboard that my office developed for addictions and mental health. And so we'll get back to you and see what we're collecting and can report.
Thank you.
This metric had been an incentive measure. It's the proportion of children who get adequate follow-up care after being prescribed ADHD medications. As a state, we've surpassed the national 90 percentile benchmark. The Metrics and Scoring Committee opted to retire this measure as an incentive measure. We will still be tracking and reporting it on a quarterly basis to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services as part of our waiver requirement, and then we will continue to report it in our annual report, but the CCOs won't be paid on it. This is a what we call a CAHPS measure. What that really means is it's a patient survey measure. And statewide, Medicaid members who reported they received needed information or help from their health plan increased. And on the surface, doesn't seem that important, but if you think about what was occurring in 2013 and with the new development of coordinated care organizations, we were very pleased and excited to see such a great increase, even though we were completely changing our system, and it may represent the good work in patient outreach and communication by the CCOs.
By the way, I don't know if you might be feeling some anxiety knowing how many slides you have that we haven't looked at yet. I have conferred briefly with Ms. Ames. There is time tomorrow, we believe, to finish this conversation. So we're not going to ask you to fly through 15 more slides in 7 minutes. We'll find a stopping point in a minute here.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Nathanson, and I'd be happy to come tomorrow and finish the presentation. This slide shows patient-centered primary care home enrollment across time, and one of the exciting pieces on this, I think, from my perspective, is we show the enrollment of all Medicaid members in patient-centered primary care homes. It increased from 2012 to 2013 quite dramatically. We were concerned about what was going to happen with the big expansion in Medicaid, and you'll see the numbers down along the bottom show the number of members who are enrolled in coordinated care organizations at that time. It jumped by 200,000, near over 200,000 people from December 2013 to the first quarter of 2014. And the CCOs were very active in contacting their members early and in making sure that they were enrolled in a patient-centered primary care home. And so that rate stayed high throughout the first three quarters of 2014. We'll be reporting the fourth quarter soon. Medicaid members receive prenatal care in the first trimester of pregnancy at a lower proportion than the general population in Oregon. So, and that's about two-thirds of members receive a prenatal visit within the first trimester. Here's the next set of measures. These are related to health system transformation. We report these measures to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, but this particular set of metrics are not incentive measures with the CCOs. The first measure, we've been showing steady decreases in hospital readmissions. In this case, a lower metric is better. And we are approaching the benchmark, which is an average of the Medicare and commercial benchmarks. So we couldn't find a Medicaid-specific benchmark for this measure. Again, this one is also a measure that is part of the hospital performance program as well. More?
Yes, Senator.
Did you separate out on the readmissions the expanded population from the OHP plus population by any chance?
The 2014 information does include expansion, so we don't have a complete picture of that yet. But we have seen it does look like it's continued to improve despite the expansion population.
Follow-up. Yes. I expect an expansion to actually improve the expansion population is younger and healthier than we expected. So I'd expect that alone would improve this number. On the other hand, when you compare this to the general population, excluding Medicare, I would expect that number to be higher because this is not as healthier a population. Medicare is elderly, so we expect a high. I mean, you got different pieces moving around here. I don't know how you're going to get a number that really makes sense for you here. I would suggest maybe just taking a good look at what you're trying to measure, and then because it is a key measure, the readmissions. Medicaid is looking at it from the point of view of if you've been hospitalized and readmitted in 30 days, what's going on? You may want to consider that as a benchmark of what your readmission rate is, and just score it for this population alone and not try to do it against any other populations. That might be pretty hard to do to get meaningful data.
Senator Bates, we for the Medicaid population, I think, to your point, we may see actual decreases in readmissions, partly just the expansion is younger, as you mentioned. We are collecting and reporting this information through the Hospital Performance Program, which includes all payers and not just Medicaid, so we can, and I can provide that information to you.
Just be thoughtful about it.
As many of you know, immunizations have been called to attention quite a bit in Oregon. More children on Medicaid have been immunized adequately by their second birthday than the general population. It's about 2/3 of the children, and this is another measure that we report regularly, but the CCOs are not currently held accountable for. We do use information both that's collected by public health and through our Medicaid claims.
Chair?
Yes?
I'm not going to ask her to explain this one, but all I point out is in the general population, it's actually going down. Am I reading that right?
Mm-hmm. Senator Bates, yes, you are.
And the Medicaid population's about flat, so I don't know what to tell you.
They're both low.
Huh?
They're both low.
Yeah, they're both low, and one's going in the wrong direction. Somehow we're not getting the message to parents how important this is.
Okay. Because I think that's an important message, I'd like to end today's hearing with that comment, rather than start into another slide that will just will also probably generate some interest.
Okay.
I think this is a good stopping point.
Thank you.
Chair, can I ask
and underscore what Senator Bates said? Yes, Representative.
If I can ask one question, whether you can bring it back tomorrow or send it another time, you said you had all payer information for hospital readmission rates, and so I would love to get that information if possible. One of my suspicions is that rate could come down if we did a better job at hitting our targets on the 7-day visit after hospitalization or even non-hospitalization mental health visits to the ER. And I hear there's a bigger problem in the private commercial insurance market than there is in OHP for care coordination upon discharge. So I'd love to get that information.
Co-chairs and Representative Kenny Geyer, yes, we can take a look at that information using all payer, all claims information.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for today. Thank you all for being here. We're adjourned.